Hey Jen,
Yeah?
did you know I have a comb in my earlobe?
Really?
Yeah, it's a lot like listening to Spaceman Blues by Brian Francis Slattery on Audible.com, only slightly more charming.
Is that so? Is it also like having your book beg for a tiger lily while milking on a drum?
Huh?
Never mind. Maybe our listeners should check out Spaceman Blues on audible.com to support this Elastic podcast.
How do they do that?
Well, they can either whisper to a starfish on a cephalopod with a leaf around a copper vein.
Or they can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and sign up for a free 1 month trial membership today. Doing so supports this podcast, plus you get a free audiobook out of the deal, which is pretty darn rhetorical, no?
Indeed, and it would make more sense than this effervescent advertisement.
Audible.com, bringing tenacity to Pompeii since April 2063.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 98.
Reading The Love Child of Cormac McCarthy and Mark Twain to find America's soul.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today's guest is Brian Francis Slattery. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, not a problem. So your new book is Lost Everything, but you've also written Liberation and Spaceman Blues. I haven't read Liberation yet, sadly, although it's in my library, so now I'm going to have to read it. But Spaceman Blues was excellent, and Lost Everything was excellent. So to kind of start things off, I guess the question I want to know is, what drew you into writing fiction particularly, since you write in a lot of different capacities? You also do music, which we may have to talk about later. But why write fiction, and why genre fiction for you?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, the question of why I write fiction, I probably the really short answer is that I don't really know. Aside from that, I really enjoy doing it. It's easier to answer the second part of that question, which is that when I first started writing things that I thought were good enough to leave the house, I honestly didn't know what genre they belonged in. I thought, well, these are either some sort of genre fiction that, you know, that enjoys playing with language, or it's literary fiction with lots and lots of genre elements in it. And I basically shopped them around to both and sort of figured I would go with whatever somebody else thought it was, because I didn't feel like deciding. And the long story short is that when I sent them to literary places, they were kind of confused by them. And when I sent them to genre places, they were like, this is really neat. So I thought, that's where I'm going to go.
The moral of the story is that genre is a very understanding kind of world.
I don't know if there's a moral. I think it's probably along the lines of, you know, the right person picked it up. It's my guess. You know, it's
go back one step though.
Sure.
How'd you get into writing in the first place?
I guess I've always done it. I'm one of those people that you know, from a young age was always kind of tooling around with writing. And I did it sort of secretly and surreptitiously. For a really long time, I guess it felt like a really long time, because I didn't take any writing classes in college or things like that. I just read a lot of stuff and constantly tried to pillage as much of it, the stuff that I liked, as I could.
Did you write horror stories that you'd tell to your friends?
No. No, but. I don't know. I was actually fairly private about the whole thing right up until I started sending things out. And in some ways right up until I actually published something. I don't know why. Don't ask me why. Like, I never did any of the I was never part of a writer's group or anything like that. It was more just like a it was more this thing that I just kind of seemed to want to do a lot.
Well, cool. To kind of get to the book, Lost Everything, which just came out on the 22nd? Did it come out?
A few weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
How would you... Because the cover blurb sort of kind of explains, gives you an impression of the book, but I guess this is a much more complex book in terms of the number of characters that are being sort of presented to us. So how would you describe this book to somebody who picked it up and then looked at you and said, hey, what is this book about?
No, I'm laughing because I'm people who know me say that I'm really terrible at describing my own books. But I always describe them by doing something really simple, which is that the main plot is really straightforward. It's a man and his friend go up a boat on the Susquehanna River to reunite with the man's son. And that's sort of the spine of the book. But then I guess I'm one of those people who really, I like books with a lot of characters in them, and I like books, I actually like a lot of like medieval literature because it's filled with all of these people. And you know, you get to know some of them pretty well and you get to know some of them less well. But I like the way that medieval literature would use it to sort of give you a snapshot of what the world looked like. You know, like the Canterbury Tales is like probably the most famous example of that, where it's by the end of that you really have a sense of what life was like for a large number of people. And so I can't resist doing that. Like I'm always just adding characters until it seems like I don't need any more characters, you know, until they finally are kind of like everything is moving forward. And then I do the best I can with all of those characters. But I mean, each of the books kind of has that. It's either a bonus or a problem, I guess, depending on who you are, but it's, yeah, they're pretty densely populated. And as a result, like the structure of the book ends up being a little bit crazier than it might otherwise be, because I'm trying not to drop the ball.
Yeah, and in this case particularly, it's linear in the sense that we end up at some future point, kinda, but it's constantly interweaving between the past and the present. It's constantly moving back to whoever the character happens to be at this moment. We go back and we learn something about an important point in their history. And it's usually right at the cusp of kind of when things, or as I say, the shit hits the fan and things start to fall apart. It's kind of like at that moment and what was going on in their lives at that second.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only thing that seems is stable in terms of the kind of narrative structure is that you have three spaces, the house, the river, and the highway. Those are the only things that stay stable, but the kind of characters that appear in these, we were moving in and out of their lives in very interesting ways. And then, of course, there's this narrator guy who I kept trying to figure out who it is, because I have this weird suspicion that he's somebody that's in the book, but I don't, then maybe it's not, because he says things and I go, I don't know who are you?
Shh, that's one of my questions.
Oh, is that one of your questions? You just wrote down, who are you?
Yes.
Okay.
I did, as a matter of fact. No, I found it really interesting, the fluidity between the different characters and the sort of snapshots of life, only because there were times where I wasn't even sure it had transitioned to a different stream, so to speak. And, you know, I had to kind of puzzle my way through it for the first couple of sentences going, okay, are we still talking from the point of view of this character or are we on someone else? And are their lives intertwined in some way? And it was at first, I mean, in the beginning, it's a kind of a difficult thing to navigate your way through. But after a period of time, then you're like, oh, okay, I get it. I see that, you know, you can better see the transitions. But it was a really interesting way to structure it. Were you kind of trying to, was it just because of the number of characters that you made such, you know, fluid transitions, or was it more that you were trying to somehow still pick up on that whole river element or the travel element of it?
Definitely the second one.
Okay.
There was a, I guess when I first started writing it, I actually wanted to write something that was a lot like the Canterbury Tales or like the Decameron or, you know, those books where it's like people get together and tell stories to each other, you know, one of those kinds of things. And meanwhile, like something crazy is happening outside. Like in the Decameron, it's like the plague is ravaging Italy. And so all these people go up into a villa and just hang out and tell each other like sexy stories. And then the Canterbury Tales is also about the plague, basically. You know, it's like the reason that they're going on the pilgrimage is that they're really grateful that they survived the winter. So, you know, it's all of that kind of stuff. But I think that, like, my experience of reading those books is that, like, with the exception of a few characters, many of them blend together in my head. And what's important to me, why I like those books, isn't because I like the characters individually necessarily, but I like the group of them, yeah, and I like the way that they interact, and I like what I get out of them, you know, as a group rather than what I get out of them out of them as individuals. So I guess that's part of it.
I found that at a certain point, I had forgotten that there was a captain and a pilot.
Yeah, right.
For the ship, even though one's male and one's female, if I remember correctly, I had lost all distinction between the two of them, because they were both so sort of wrapped up in the river and being on the boat and everything. So, and that was a tricky thing to piece out in the story, was the sort of the differences between them two. One is named, and they're both named, but the name isn't always mentioned when they're the focus.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess part of it was also that I, because the book ended up being considerably darker than I was expecting it to be, I had this feeling that I was like, you know, if I'm going to write a book this dark, it should at least be sort of shorter. You know, it's not like 800 pages of you know, pretty rough material. And I think also is that I kind of wanted to keep the focus on the couple of central characters. Like I wanted like their story to be more important than the other stories when it came down to it. Especially Sonny Jim's story, because his past is such an important part of, to me at least, of, you know, why he's doing what he's doing and why he's willing to go to the lengths that he's going to go to.
Yeah. Right. I guess one of the sort of central themes in the book is the kind of psychological turmoil involved in losing one's home. And I'm using home in kind of scare quotes, because that means a lot of different things to different characters, what they mean by home. And almost all of the characters in this book are refugees in some way. They've been moved from their home, or they've chosen to move from it. They've been pushed out by the weather, or they've been pushed out by other people, or by war, and all these kinds of issues. And so, yet this turmoil seems to place the kind of stationary home versus the mobile home in opposition, because there's no sort of stable home in here, particularly since most of the book takes place on the river, on the Carthage, this very large, like, cobbled together boat thing, like some sort of like Frankenstein boat. And I guess that's the way I would describe it, because there's even a point in the book where they realize, like, they've got holes in the boat, and they're like, well, we just got to find some wood and metal, and let's just nail it on there, and that'll fix the problem. And you get the clear impression that this is a boat that, like, at some point was probably like a rowboat, and then they just started, like, attaching things to it until it became this massive thing.
I like that very much.
So I guess I wanted you to talk about what kind of drew you to the river as this place that becomes almost a safe haven, but it's not quite, but it's like the safest place a lot of these people could be. And kind of what was the impetus behind the river as being this central area for you?
Oh, that's good. I mean, well, part of it is just that I like river stories. You know, like there's a million of them, right? And I tend to really like them. And one of the things that they kind of have in common is that, like, while the people are on, generally speaking, in the river story, when the people are on the boat, like, things are kind of okay. And it's only when they get off the boat that there's trouble. You know, you like that happens that happens over and over again. Like if you, that's true of Huck Finn. That's definitely true of like Heart of Darkness, right? Where it's like, right, they're kind of fine as long as they're moving, but then as soon as they stop, you know, crazy things happen. Mm. And I kind of wanted to write a book like that. I think that the biggest reason for picking like that river is because this is going to sound like very sort of precious and arty, but like for a long time, I'd wanted to write a book about the place that I grew up, which is upstate New York. And it has to me at least, and even when I was growing up there, like, and I had no like other frame of reference to look at it. Like it always seemed like part of what I liked about it was that it was kind of this like spooky sort of place, or at least certainly parts of it were. And, you know, I wanted to sort of tap into that, and I hadn't been able to do it. Like I wrote a bunch of stuff that I really disliked and immediately, you know, threw in the garbage. And then, you know, eventually I sort of figured that the best way to, the best way to write about it was to literally approach it. So, you know, I had the characters getting closer and closer and closer to it, you know, and that ended up sort of working out, and it ended up being like the kind of book that I felt like I'd been trying to write for quite a while.
And it was interesting too that you just kind of brought it up. There's also this sense like they're getting away from something that's literal in the book, but that there are all of these little pieces in the book that are these kind of hints I don't want to say salvation, that's really the wrong word, but like I think there's a point in the book fairly early in the book where they talk about Aaron, Sonny Jim's son, as being like a good luck charm, like the war could not touch them when they're with the son. And we're not quite sure if this is actually true or if it's just like a series of events happens and they just assume it's true, but they still send the son away because I guess they really don't want him. Maybe there's some sense that the son is going to be damaged even if the war never like literally hits him. But there's all these kind of little hints in the book of these things that are slightly mystical. And even like I think there's a con artist in this book, and I don't want to ruin it, but there's a point where things quote unquote go right for him finally, and not in the way that is expected. The complete opposite, but things just suddenly magically go right for him.
Well, and then other characters have foreknowledge of events, and I think that was a pretty consistent thing.
Yeah, the captain who is like waiting for the river to tell him, like this is the moment when everything.
Her.
Yeah, to tell her that this is finally the moment when the river's gonna do its thing and take over, and then the Frankenstein boat will sink, and it'll be really sad.
And her mother had the same ability. Yeah.
This way to read the river. There's all these kinds of mystical things. And I guess the thing is I've never lived by a river. I've never lived anywhere where the river was like central to the culture in some significant way. And so I guess the question I have for people who maybe you yourself, because you seem to have a very large connection to the river, is this kind of part of the culture, like a quote unquote river culture?
No, I mean, what's kind of interesting about the Susquehanna River is that it's actually sort of largely ignored because it was never, it was and still is unnavigable. It's too shallow to get a boat up. So for a long time, people wanted to make it kind of a central thing to upstate New York and Pennsylvania, but it never really worked out. So there are towns along the river, and they're, you know, like all the towns that are in the book are actually there. But it's not like a huge part of the culture there. It's just this kind of big body of water that nobody's ever been able to figure out what to do with. Part of the quote unquote research for this book was actually to take a trip down the Susquehanna River, which was totally awesome. But one thing that really hit me and the two friends that I managed to convince to come with me was like how not utilized the river was, like for how big it is. It's like a mile across, and it feels like a huge body of water. But then like we were in like a canoe, and then you could get out of the canoe at just about any point, and you'd be like up to your waist.
Oh my goodness!
So it was kind of interesting, the more sort of mystical elements to it. I'm not sure. I mean, that's something that I seem to like. You know, like, there are people like that in each of the three books. And I've never been quite able to explain why I like having characters that have these kind of weird sort of clairvoyant powers. But they do. And I guess part of it is, like, you know, part of it is that they're, you know, this is going to sound even weirder, but there are people that you meet who do kind of have this kind of sense of certainty about things. Like, they sort of say, well, you know, things are going to get really bad, or, you know, oh, things are going to get better. And they say it with this kind of, like, air of serene certainty that makes it all sort of plausible, especially when they turn out to be right. You know, they seem pretty darn clairvoyant.
And creepy sometimes too.
Yeah. And you know, what can I say? I mean, I guess the other part of it is that, you know, the upstate New York, Pennsylvania thing is kind of famous for it's like the cradle of a few different utopian communities that ended up being a big part of American history. And, like, I kind of wanted to get at that a little bit, that there seems to be something about the area that encourages people to think that way, because there really, you know, there really was, like, you know, in the 1800s, it was like, it was the cradle for, like, Mormonism, but it was also the cradle for a couple of other societies that came and went. And I've always been interested in them. You know, these people who decide that they're just going to make things better. And, like, there's something that I really admire about it, and there's another, you know, at the same time, there's something kind of creepy about it, right? That sort of, that certainty that things are going to go a certain way, and then you're acting as if they've already happened, and, you know, that can get really, really creepy really fast.
Well, I mean, one of the big things about the imagery of a river is that it's sort of inexorable, you know, and you know that there's going to be an end, you know, regardless of how much you might want to travel on the river forever and ever in the same direction, it will end. And that sort of foresight, you know, is kind of a natural part of that imagery. I wanted to bring up, though, the fact that, I mean, the Susquehanna as it stands might not have a specific culture on the river, but presumably it's a floodplain, and I imagine there's fairly rich agricultural land around it. So how much of the land-based river culture is there?
In the book, I mean, it's actually hard for me to dissociate myself too much from it, because it is kind of like it is sort of like the place where I grew up. And there is definitely, there's a lot of what I think of as, like, the attitude of people who live there, you know, like, right down to the sort of the narrative voice, you know, which is sort of there are a lot of people who kind of talk that way, you know, like, it's sort of, like, simple but very direct, and occasionally sort of you know, there are people who startle you with something, like, particularly insightful, that kind of comes out of nowhere. You know, they'll be talking about their cow, and then suddenly they make this grand statement, and it's great. You know, and you're like, wow, that was actually pretty meaningful, that thing you just said, even though we were talking about your farm, you know, or, you know, things like that.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. So, this kind of ties hand in hand with, you know, the end of the river, so to speak, because the journey, I believe, is taking place going north. And it's heading directly towards two of what I saw as kind of the strongest characters in the book. One is the big storm, or the big one, and the other is the war. And they're heading directly into both. I mean, the war and the storm are kind of converging on one another at a certain point in time.
Well, they're moving away from the storm, but they're going into the war.
No, I believe they're moving directly towards the storm.
It was the storm I thought was coming from the west.
Northwest. Wasn't it northwest? Or was it just west?
In some ways, you're both right.
Well, I guess to some extent, all the people on the boat know that they're not going to escape the storm. They're just trying to get somewhere where they feel, I guess, comfortable in stopping to ride it out. And some of them don't think they're going to ride it out. They think that they're going to get off the boat and then they're going to, like, eat some corn and drink some beer and just disappear.
They're also heading directly towards, you know, where the war is coming in too, because the war is marching on towards the north as, you know, they're traveling in the same direction. There's like, for the people on the boat, there's literally no escaping really anything. And yet they still all have this idea that they're going to travel to a place and they're going to go back to their roots. A lot of them are returning to where they started from in the beginning, possible years in the past. And that's not my question, but it was a really interesting part of the book. So the storm and the war, they're both kind of rolling over the land and eating up everything in the path. And both are portrayed fairly similarly in that sense. But one seems a little bit more pure in, obviously, motivations. Do you see the two as two similar things or contrast elements? Or are they just part of a greater whole?
I mean, to me, they're different because there's, you know, the... So the war... I mean, not that much of all of what I'm about to say ended up in the book, but it certainly like heavily informed it, which is that the war is actually sort of based on wars as they're conducted in Africa right now, where there's this crazy, you know, there's no single cause, you know, people and they drag on for a long, long, long time, and you know, people are never feeling safe. You know, while they're, you know, while the war is going on, and to me that felt like a very different thing than the climate changey angle. You know, of just eventually there's this really big one that comes along, I don't see them as being, I mean, ultimately to me at least. I'm one of those people who thinks that once an author is done with a book, then like their interpretation of their own book doesn't hold a hell of a lot of weight. But you know, to me, it's that like the climate change angle is what drove everything else. You know, that when you, I mean, from my day job, I edit public policy stuff, and when people talk about climate change, at least in the policy realm, what they quickly move to is like what the sort of political and social effects of it would be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at those very sobering things of, you know, like all of Bangladesh ends up underwater or something, like, well, those people are going to go somewhere, you know, and then where are they going to go? And, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, you could see how that sort of inexorable change would lead to some really, really profound changes in the political and social environment. Right. So, I mean, those are the way that they're connected, but I think they're connected sort of farther back. But then meanwhile, like the climate change thing would still be happening. It's not just like, hey, things changed and, you know, now we're dealing with this new reality. It's like both dynamics are still going on.
Yeah. That's really depressing about the whole war thing. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, yeah, but my next question, it actually ties in with that because it did seem hopeless. I mean, and other reviewers have mentioned that there's, you know, a certain hopelessness and cynicism to the story. But I totally found it exactly the opposite. That sort of the inevitability, the inexorable quality of it, of nature taking back over, of kind of wiping the world clean, that made it, there was a possibility of new life. You know, it was full of hope, full of possibilities. Mm. So obviously, even though you just said that your, you know, interpretation has nothing to do with everybody else's, how did you find it? Did you find it hopeless or did you find it hopeful?
I don't find it. Okay, this is kind of a fun way to do it. One way that I've like, you know, all definitely the last two books, but certainly all three of them to some extent keep getting described as post-apocalyptic. And right. I actually like the word apocalyptic better because it's like, yeah, you know, there's that double meaning of apocalypse, which is that it's sort of like the end of things, but it's also when something gets revealed, like and I'm really sort of interested in that. And so I kind of see them as sort of two sides of the same coin. And I should say that, you know, once I realized that for a long time, I resisted writing a book this dark. And it took me a long time to sort of come around to the idea that I even wanted to. And then once I did it, I did try to work pretty hard to show the other side of it. And one thing that made that sort of easier to do was having a priest in the book, you know, who doesn't necessarily see the end of something as being strictly a cause for despair. You know, like he's kind of built into the things he believes is this quite massive kernel of hope, you know, that like things are going to go badly, but then they might actually go very, very well. And that there's, you know, part of, I think, for me as a sort of hardcore agnostic, was one thing that was really fun and also sort of tough mentally to sort out was like, could I come up with sort of a secular version of that, you know, that would sort of bring those two characters together, you know, that like they don't like that Sonny Jim doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, as firm in his spiritual convictions as the priest is, in order for the two of them to kind of see it the same way, that there's like reasons to keep going on, you know, there's reasons to keep hoping that things will get better, like even though the situation right in front of you doesn't give you a lot of evidence of that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually saw the book quite hopeful in its despair.
That pleases me immensely, because I definitely didn't want to write this book that was just this colossal downer. And I mean, I knew that some people, I mean, it's hard to get past the central premise, you know, it's it's totally understandable, but for me at least, I didn't see the point of writing a book that would just be, that would have nothing but like, hey, we're all doomed. Yeah, you know, like that didn't seem fair, and it's not the sort of book that I would necessarily want to read. So, yeah. and I have that sort of thing where when I'm watching a movie or reading a book that's really dark, there's always that part of me that's going, you know, you better have a reason for making me go through all of this. Like I want something at the end that's going to justify feeling so bad, you know. So I did try to do that, and of course, like, you know. You know, your mileage may vary regarding how successful I was.
Well, I thought one of the interesting things, too, is on this very topic was I know you're a musician, and that there's a lot of attention paid to this band on the Carthage, the ship, the Frankenstein ship.
Yeah.
This sort of, and there's even a point in the book, and I'm not going to tell anybody, you should read it because it's fairly late in the book, but there's a point in the book where you sort of explain their history, where they came from, and their their own kind of mystical connection to things. And I did think it was so interesting that, like, you know, a lot of these characters really do think that the big one's going to come and that they're just all going to die. But they're like, you know what? I don't care. I'm going to, like, play blues and jazz music, and we're going to dance and get sweaty and like drink crap loads of beer, we're gonna have fun, and just almost this point of like in defiance, like I should be depressed and like fleeing for my life in the most insane way possible, stealing trucks and just drive into Canada or whatever, but the in complete defiance of that and just saying, no, we're gonna flee, but we're gonna go on our own time, we're gonna have a blast as we go, which is part of what I kind of see as one of the optimistic points of this novel, is like even in the face of what they perceive to be as like impending doom, they're kind of saying, well, whatever, like this is humanity, like we'll make the best of a bad situation. So
I mean, that's actually, you know, if I had to pick a thing, that's probably closest to sort of my own you know, my own mindset. And I think that the like the musicians are, as a musician, I know a lot of other musicians. And I think that many of them have that same sort of feeling. Like, it's probably what we would do. And you'd say, like, whatever, what are we going to do? Like, let's have fun. Like, we can stop working at our day jobs now. And, you know, and just get a bunch of food together. And then, like, we'll do, you know, we'll go for as long as we can. But the music part of it is kind of, I mean, it's hard for me to get away from it because it's such a sort of big part of my own life. But it's also that it seemed like a neat way, and a lot of me, I mean, I, to some extent, feel this way about it. And I've certainly heard other musicians talk about it, is that, like, music is for musicians. It can be its own sort of form of spirituality, you know, that like, it's that same sense of, like, you're, that something bigger is out there that you sort of get access to every once in a while. And that, like, that can be a source of, like, some real sort of optimism, you know, and it can make you feel better when things are bad and all those sort of, like, those silly cliches about music that are also really true.
And you just made me think, too, of two scenes, like, in the Titanic when the, like, string quartet plays all this music while the ship is going down and all the people are trying to get on the boats. Or even if anyone's seen Band of Brothers, there's a scene after one of the German cities had been, like, bombed and is completely ruined, and all the people are cleaning up, and, like, in the middle are, again, another string quartet, and they're playing, like, Beethoven or something in the street. And it's really this sad song, but it's also one of these, like, really beautiful scenes where this amazing music is being played. And I'm thinking the same kind of, all of these are kind of connected. There is something kind of mystical about music.
Yeah, there certainly can be. I mean, there certainly can be. And I feel like I'm, like, breaking some sort of code by talking about it out loud. But there is that feeling of, like, you know, if there's a group of people and you all play together really well, then there's a point where, like, the music stops and you all just kind of look at each other and nobody says anything and everybody goes to bed, you know, because it's like, wow, that was really something, whatever just happened there. Yeah. And eventually there's something very cool about being able to tap into that again and again, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I played trumpet for many, many years.
There you go.
And it is. It's very almost cathartic to play music.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's just probably why when I get sad, I listen to, like, 80s songs and dance around my apartment. So.
Yeah, or whatever.
I've never had that connection, so I feel like I'm losing out on something.
You are, Jen. Your life is completely...
I totally am.
Pick up the kazoo or something.
Yeah, no. I'm really not much of a music person. It's really interesting because I have two kids who are doing band and are really enjoying it. But I have never been as into music as a lot of other people. Let's just put it that way. So I realized that over the course of this, we've totally neglected the soldiers in this story. And I don't have any framed questions about them. But especially their final scenes are really fascinating with, you know, Ketcher, Jackson, Tannenbaum, and Largeman.
Yeah.
Who I think is actually ends up being one of the most interesting sort of possibilities. And they have some very troubling experiences, and, you know, Tannenbaum's conversations with commanders and other people, they definitely feel the futility of what they're doing. Their heart's just not in it, but it's still their job, and they're going to do it regardless. Can you talk a little bit about your inclusion of them and how their journey plays into what's happening on the river?
Yeah, that's great. So the soldiers. Now, I don't have any. Obviously, I don't have any wartime experience. I'm not. I just haven't. What I have done, thanks to my day job and the various things that, you know, you read about in school to you know, before you end up getting a job in the public policy world, is. I've read a lot of accounts of soldiers in wartime and what they sort of go through. The interesting thing that sort of came out was what you were describing, that it's like obviously the things that they are forced to do will continue to affect them. And at the same time, like, there's a way that they're able to, at least some soldiers are able to separate out the sort of reason that they're there from the fact that, like, it's their job to be there.
Right.
And that at a certain point, like, it is that's just their job. Like, why are you doing it? Well, it's my job. You know, it pays the bills. And, like, that a soldier is fully capable of doing their job, even if they don't believe at all in what the, you know, what the the reason for the mission. Like they don't, some of them just don't need that. But that it's like, I guess the other part of it is that I was really interested in getting into the, I try sort of hard not to sort of have the, you know, the heroes and villains, perpetrators and victims, you know, like, I mean, you know, that even the perpetrators are damaged by the things that they do. And I was really interested in getting into that. So, I mean, that was sort of the reason why the soldiers are the way they are.
Yeah, they were really interesting, especially, like I said, you know, sort of large man's post-narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some really, you know, really chilling accounts of, yeah, you know, the, you know, child soldiers who are now, you know, who they and people trying to help them are trying to reintegrate them into society. And it's really hard. You know, it's like they spent their childhood, you know, shooting people, and it does something to you, obviously. And it's, you know, I was interested in trying to write a little bit about that, you know, without completely misrepresenting everything. But that, you know, that was certainly part of it, because they're quite amazing stories. And yeah, they like those stories in particular seem to be the most acute version of something that I imagine many soldiers go through. You know, that they just did these crazy, horrific things, and it was kind of all in the course of a job, and now they're sort of told, well, the job's gonna be ending soon. And, you know, and then, like, what's on your resume now? Like, you have to get another job. You know, someone's going to ask you, what did you do before this? And, you know, what are you going to tell them? And, you know, how are they supposed to feel about that? And how are you supposed to feel about it? And all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Have you guys, either of you seen The Pacific?
Mm-mm. I have not watched The Pacific yet.
Okay. There's a scene that's exactly like this at the last episode of The Pacific, when one of the characters comes back and he's going to sign up for college, and he spent the last, I don't know, 3 years or whatever in the war in Japan, in the islands in Japan fighting. And the person's asking him, you know, what are all your skills, you know, and like, what did you do in the military? And he's saying, and, you know, and she's like, well, don't you have any other skills in the military? Teach you anything else? He's like, ma'am, they taught me how to kill Japs. You know, and I was really good at it.
Yeah.
And like that, I mean, there's a point at which, you know, if that's all you know, and this perhaps goes into Largeman's sort of what Jen's talking about, these possible scenarios of what might happen to him at when this war ends.
Yeah. Or you think about like did you guys see The Hurt Locker?
Yes.
I did.
Like,
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. Yes. The last 10 minutes of that are so great. Yeah. You know, when he goes home and he's just like standing in the aisle of the grocery store.
Yeah.
And you just go, wow, that's, you know, that's like, crazy. It's crazy.
Like, how do you go back to a mundane life?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And there is a certain sense too, like, you know, in Hurt Locker, that his problem is he's really good at his job, and it's also what for him has become his like lifeline, his thrill. Like, that's how he gets through his day, is by, you know, defusing bombs, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's
like, this is not a guy who's now going to like get a job at Home Depot. You know, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, what would he do? I mean, get imagine that doing all those kinds of things, that trying to rewire your brain for quote unquote normal life would be incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's the same thing going on in this book. I mean, even with Sergeant Foote, who's the one of the other military figures that Jen had not brought up. And she's supposedly kind of sort of the like secret agent kind of character here, has a secret mission to search for Sonny Jim and Reverend Bauxite. But that same problem, like, you know, you have a mission, you're just supposed to do it, but then you get to that point and it's like, for her, I guess the question becomes, can I actually do this, and what's the frickin' point?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I won't say anything more than that, because that'll ruin really interesting parts of the book. So,
okay, so I'm getting to my deep question, super deep. Not really. No. So you have a character that is in the entire book, but only in bits and pieces here and there, and he is the only first person. I assume it's a he. I could be wrong. So, who is this sort of privileged character that gets to see these snapshots of life and hear these stories? And what do you think becomes of them?
So the narrator was, you know, in some ways he's, and I think of him as a he, but just because that's sort of randomly assigned, I have to admit. The narrator's like the, I mean, on one hand, he's one of the, like, leftovers from the two drafts of the book ago, when the book was actually more like a sort of medieval thing, you know, which always has a narrator. There's always an I, like this guy who just, you know, who knows all the people. Hmm. But so the narrator developed, like, as subsequent drafts went on, the narrator developed into something more like, in medieval things, they tend to be a little bit more like a disembodied narrator. But as it kind of went on, I got more interested in the thing of, well, if the narrator isn't omniscient, I can actually make him sort of a person. And I actually imagine him as a person who like, a, you know, there's a physical guy who went around and tried to piece the whole story together. And he did it by, you know, by meeting all the people he needed to meet, which led to all kinds of annoying editorial problems, because there was a, well, how would the narrator know this and how would the narrator know that? And, you know, once it was decided that he was a real dude. But I do actually picture him as like a guy who wrote that book, you know, and who wrote it the best he could with the really limited knowledge that he had. And that one of the reasons the book is kind of fragmented is because it's sort of a complicated story and he didn't have a lot of time, you know? So it's, so like as a device for the book, the narrator got pretty interesting because it ended up dictating a lot about like what the book could and couldn't be. And really more the second one, like what I wasn't allowed to say. Cause in the other two books I'd written, the narrator is totally omniscient. You know, mm-hmm. So he can do whatever he wants, but like this guy really has some severe limitations. You know, there's certain things he's never going to know, and he kind of has to speculate, but he's trying hard not to speculate. You know, he's trying to tell you just what he managed to learn. And I picture him more like an investigative reporter. Like he meets these people and then interviews them for a long time, and he tries to get as much out of them as he can so he can figure out this story, and that, you know, he wants to tell this story because he sees hope in it. And he's kind of hoping that if he doesn't make it, that at least what he wrote will.
Right.
And that, like, you know, somebody who makes it will be able to read it, you know, and get some sense of what life was like during that point, which is another sort of medieval thing. You know, it's like the back, like way back, even before then, you know, that the Beowulf poet is sort of worried about that kind of stuff too. You know, and Chaucer is worried about it, and Boccaccio is worried about it. You know, they want, to some extent, they want to make a document, you know, of the time that they lived in.
Yeah.
And it is interesting too, because with this narrator, there is a point in the book that he admits that he's taking, I guess you'd say, he's not quite lying, but he's taking creative liberties with certain parts of the story. Mm-hmm. As a way to fill in gaps or to give a greater impression of whatever it is that he's learned. And I'm not going to say that what those particular scenes are, but there is a sense that he's like, he is bound to this limitation and he wants to go outside of it, but he knows if he goes too far, he's crossed the line. But he still kind of asks the audience for forgiveness for any inaccuracies in his telling.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess like the other part of it is that I've always had this kind of love-hate relationship with the impulse to develop your characters completely, because it feels like a real invasion of privacy to me. You know, there's like a, you know, there's a point where you go like, you know, you don't need to know every single thing, but on the other hand, like, you know, obviously you want to know something about them, and I liked having this character who kind of couldn't develop the characters as much as he wanted to. You know, he wanted to, he wishes he knew them all much, much better than he does, but he only has what he has.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's very interesting. I like the, the kinds of the I sections with this particular narrator. I thought they were very interesting. And unlike Jen, at first I didn't know what to do with them. And Jen seems to have her head on with who this person is, expecting it to be a real person, and I wasn't sure who he was.
I mean, I don't think from the very beginning, but it's I think the second time that he enters the scene, he talks about his daughter. And that it almost seems as if the story is written for her to find her. So, yeah, I guess I did. Sorry.
It's all your fault, Jen. I hate you.
Good work, everybody.
We're attentive readers sometimes.
We try to be, at least. So.
Okay, so are we ready for our quick fives?
Sure.
Okay. These should be fairly easy, but one of them is really hard, so you may have to think. So, first question, the river or the ocean?
That's a question.
Yep.
The ocean.
Okay, giant houseboat or agile sailboat?
giant houseboat.
All right, good choice. Hunting or fishing?
Fishing.
Okay. Cowering in the dark or trying to save humanity?
those are some pretty severe choices.
Right?
I'm gonna go with the second one.
All right, saving humanity. Okay, and the fifth question, the real hard one is, if a storm was going to wipe out your town in 10 minutes, what one thing would you take with you on your houseboat, other than family, because we can assume they're going to come, and also assuming that all the people in the town are going to live. So you have to choose a stuff thing.
It's just one thing?
One thing. Mm-hmm. You can only take one. You only have time for one thing.
My violin.
Ooh.
Wow, he had that quick.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because so in the fall, there Hurricane Irene did a pretty good number on where we lived. Mm-hmm. And there was a point where we had to drive back we were visiting my parents, and then we had to drive back like in time for the storm. And so I had, there's a part of me going like, why are we going in this direction when we could be somewhere else? But, but in any case, in the car at one point, there was my family, and I had my fiddle and my banjo in the back, and we had like a couple of days worth of clothes. And it occurred to me, like, this is actually pretty much all we need. You know, because as I'm driving back, I'm going, you know, I could just take a left onto 91 and like head up to Canada, and we're fine. Like, everything we actually need is in this car right now.
Have you discussed this with your family?
Well, actually, I mentioned it at the time.
I'm very curious how they took it.
Well, no,
what else would you take?
Oh no, because we were all. I mean, my son thankfully is young enough to not feel resentful about these things. But both of us were feeling resentful that we had to go back. So.
I think it seems like a perfectly reasonable to take along with you, because like when I think about the question, I'm like, well, I think I'd take my hard drive. I don't know if I could actually use it ever again, but it has every picture ever taken of my family. And therefore, I think it would be the only thing that I'd really be like, yeah, I could take that. You know, it's one of those things that, like, you look around your house and go, what is the most precious thing in here to me? And hopefully most people answer, well, my family. And
it was good of you to preempt that choice.
Yeah.
Well, I had to, because I knew you would say your family.
Every other human being who is
not
peaceful.
A sociopath, right.
We would learn something very bad about you if you said, well, screw my family, I'm going to take my violin.
Exactly. You're like, what is wrong with you? Oh, my God.
I might also take The Neverending Story. That'll be mine.
You got that book is awfully good.
It is awfully good.
Mm-hmm. I would just take my Nook. I'd get about 3 days worth of power out of it, then I'd have to find a solar powered generator, and then it would work.
That's hilarious.
I'd figure out how to survive for about 3 weeks, and then I'd probably die because I'd drink some bad water or something. I'm pretty screwed if the apocalypse comes. Actually, I'm not. I've got a contingency plan for the zombie invasion, so
excellent.
Yeah. Everybody does these days. That's kind of the interesting thing about the zombie sort of story and the prevalence in today's society, is that everybody kind of goes, where would I go?
Yeah.
What would I do? My husband has a whole plan. And I always think it's an idiotic plan, but, you know, whatever.
Well, you should get that hashed out now, because it'd be really bad to be arguing over it in the moment, you know.
When the big storm and the war are converging on our points, then yes, might not be the time to make that decision.
Oh, goodness. All right, so Brian, where can people find you, and do you have any sort of convention appearances, or are you going to be, well, you play music, so I'm assuming you're going to be putting on musical shows?
So, I mean, actually, just tonight is my first reading, which I tend to haul along a little band to do with, because why not? Because I can. That's tonight, which is going to be too late, I imagine, for that to come out. But then on when does this come out?
It'll go up today.
Oh, is it going
up today? Yeah.
Cool. It'll go up today.
So when's tonight? And then May 17th, in New York, I have a reading with the same band, and that's going to be really fun. And I am going to ReaderCon, and I can't remember the dates of that. It's in mid-July somewhere. And of course, I'm always playing music out. Because that's just what I do. But that's usually around New Haven, because apparently we haven't completely worn out our welcome in the town we live in, and you know, keeps things interesting.
And your website?
My website is pretty easy. It's www.bfslattery.com. So it's my first two initials and then my last name, and that's it.
Yep. And everything will be on there too, right? Just in case people need to hunt you down and send you hate mail.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really easy. I'm really easy to reach, especially because I email all the time, probably when I'm asleep too.
Cool. Well, it was really great to have you on. It was really awesome to finally get to interview you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. This is really fun. I'm glad there was so much laughing considering the book itself.
Oh, we're not very good at being serious anyway, so...
That's the thing. Neither am I. That's the... this whole book was a big surprise to me. I was thinking, God, I'm just not that serious a person. What's going on?
And then you wrote a great book, so hey.
Yeah, that happened.
It happens, you know, once in a while, you know.
it was a wonderful read, and we highly recommend it to all of our listeners. And we don't always do that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was really great. So everyone should read it, and you should get Spaceman Blues too if you don't have it, because if you don't have it, you need to read that too.
And Liberation, theoretically.
And Liberation, yeah. I would assume that one's a really good one too, but I didn't want to jump the gun. You know, it might be the one book that I don't like, but I doubt it. I'll probably love that too.
It's fair.
All right, thanks again, Brian, and that's it.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you soon.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.